back. And he's saying, so if all of those things are true, then make my joy complete by being of the same mind, maintaining the same love, united in spirit, intent on one purpose. He really uses four statements to repeat or restate basically one concept here, that we're to be in a relationship with one another that will later be defined here. Here is in the sense of same mind, but it's this humility toward one another. Verse 3 becomes the exhortation, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit. In contrast with that, there's to be humility. In contrast to the empty conceit is humility, and that's further explained by regarding one another as more important than yourself, and not merely looking out for your own interests, but include what's beneficial to others in your haven of oversight. Having said those things, then Paul moves in really what becomes an example. Verses 5, especially 5 to 8, become this phenomenal theological statement, but in the context, it's real. I mean, it is a theological statement. There's no way to get away from it being theological. But its purpose isn't to explain a point of theology. His purpose is clearly to be illustrative of his point and to give us an example of how to love, and to show that this humility is clearly something that should be between believers, for it is exactly what characterizes the one in whom we follow. And so he begins in verse 5 and he says, have this attitude in yourselves, which also was in Christ Jesus. Have this attitude. Well, this is looking backwards. Have this attitude. Which attitude? Well, the attitude he's just talked about specifically back in verse 2, where it said, be of the same mind. That being of the same mind is further described in this passage as humility. Specifically, never let selfishness or conceit be your guide. Never let it be what is directing you. Secondly, it says, regard others as more important than yourself. So it's this perspective of how we look at other people. And then thirdly, not to limit our attention to our own personal needs, our own personal issues, but include the interests, the needs of others. So it's that humility is defined or outlined almost in those three ways in this section. So he's saying that's the attitude that we're supposed to have. Well, he's already told us that once. Now he's telling us again, have this attitude in yourselves. But he makes a further statement here. This is exactly the attitude that was in Christ. This is the same attitude that Christ has. So he's saying that Christ wasn't selfish. Christ regarded others as more important than himself. And that Christ didn't simply look for his own interest, but he included the interest of others. And having said that, then he expounds and explains how that could be true. Because when you really think about it, that doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? I mean, it does to us in Christianity, because as long as you've been a Christian, and perhaps before you were a Christian, as long as you've been around a Christian church, you've heard these things. That's who Christ is, that God is love. But no other world religion does that. Nobody else has God taking the role of a servant, God coming down to be man so that he can somehow provide for man. The closest that you could come would be the Greek gods, that they somehow were demigods, that they somehow lived on earth, they were supermen, so to speak. So there was this relationship, this identity with people, but it wasn't to serve people, it was to be over people. It was a superiority. But here, as we'll see through this passage, Christ, it's just almost a stair step as he lowers himself in the sense of humility. And so the attitude of Jesus is seen in his actions here. It's saying have the same attitude that Jesus had, but how do you define an attitude? How can I say to you know, well, have the attitude that Joe has? Well, what is the attitude that Joe has? Well, I can describe his attitude. Well, he's positive. He's this. You're like, well, what does that look like? So with Jesus, we're told have this attitude. It's an attitude of humility. Well, let me show you his actions so that you can see how that is true and what it looks like. And that's what he does in this passage here. The term that we find here, have this attitude, is the same word that's defined as mind earlier when it says have this same mind, which is the same concept, have this same attitude among yourself. So we're to have a common attitude among ourselves, which is identical with the attitude that Jesus had. And so verse 6 moves into the existence of God, that he existed in the form of God. Seems like a kind of a silly statement to be making from our perspective, since we take it at face value. And it's in our creedal statements that Jesus is God, that God exists in Trinity. But here, Paul is making this statement, and it's a little, as you read this, kind of going, well, you know, this could have been stated a little simpler. And it's almost in universal agreement that this section, 6 through 8, at least, if not more, was some type of poetry, some type of a hymn, that it's likely, though no certainty here, it's likely not original with Paul, that this was some saying, some hymn in the early church that looked at the deity of Christ, and Paul takes it and adapts it here for his purpose. And as that may explain somewhat of the challenge with some of the terms. It says he existed in the form of God, or the NIV says being in very nature God. Well, he existed, looking at his pre-incarnation existence, that prior to the virgin birth, prior to walking upon the earth, prior to spending those years in ministry with his disciples, prior to going to the cross, he existed, the pre-existence of Christ. He existed, and how did he exist? He existed in the form of God. Form, this word form only occurs twice in the New Testament, both in this section, in this verse, and in the next verse where it says he took the form of a bond servant. The only two times it occurs in the Bible. It's looking at his essential nature. What is the essential nature, the essential character of God? That's as we're looking at in this one, he existed in the form of God. Those things that are essential, those things that make him God, that's who he was. What God is himself, that is, in his very deepest being. It's kind of a cautious way of saying that he possessed the very nature of God. But it would appear that the reason this term is used here, which is not as clear as perhaps we would like, what do you mean he existed in the form of God? Why not just say he was God? We'd be much more happy with that. But it's plain in this whole section here to link up with the next part that he was in the form of a slave. And so there's one word that's being chosen that works with both. And it's looking at what is the essential nature. What's the essential nature of God? That's what he was. What's the essential nature of a slave? That's what he was. And so he appeared in this form, or he existed in the form of God. He came to earth and existed in the form of a slave. Both of those are true of Jesus, the incarnation. Having stated that although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped. So this form of God is paralleled with equality to God. So when it's saying he existed in the form of God, it's not saying he just kind of had some form that resembled God. It's very clear that this form of God is the same as being God, because here is speaking of in terms of equality with God. But look at his attitude. He did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped or a thing to be seized or a thing to be held on to tightly. Now, the challenge to this passage is not to take Christ in his deity and somehow understand the passage in such a way that we strip the deity from Christ. So when he's saying he doesn't regard equality with God something to be held on to, not in the sense that somehow he lets go of his deity. If God can stop being God, then by definition he wasn't God. I mean, how could you stop being God? You cannot stop being if you're by very nature self-existent, a necessary being. So it's not that there was some sense of who he is as God and he stopped wanting that, or he wasn't going to hold on to that and somehow therefore it can float away. It would seem to be a poetic way of saying that as Jesus, the second person in the Trinity, looked at all the rights, all the privileges, all that's involved in being God, he said, I'm not going to hold on to my position in such a way that it precludes me from taking the role that God's called me to, from taking the role, as we'll see, of a servant. Now, that, like I said earlier, that makes sense to us because we've heard it, but it makes absolutely no sense in a world of privilege, in a world where rank and prestige means something, where people vie for that position. Last fall, we watched the Donald Trump's show, The Apprentice. And on one episode, as it narrowed down to the last two people, their assignment as they were divided up, Trump goes to each event that they're supposed to be raising this money for these charities. And the one guy knew that it was about time for Trump to arrive, even though he had all this stuff that he needed to be doing. He said, it's essential, it's important, it's a must that I have to be out there when his helicopter sets down. You know, I've got to personally greet him and escort him in. Well, when he went to the other place, the girl did not do that, and Trump commented on it later about how he had to walk in. Now, you can have whatever opinion you want to of Donald Trump, and I'm not trying to make him out because he wanted that recognition. That's normal for people in those positions. It's expected. You know, you look at the way dignitaries are greeted. Look at the way that President Bush is greeted when he steps off an airplane, when he steps off the helicopter, when some other person of notoriety comes to the White House, how they're treated. That's what we expect. That's this protocol. I understand if you meet these individuals, somebody tells you first what's the proper protocol. This is what you can do. Like I mentioned before, we had a friend that had the opportunity to speak with former President Bush. He was on A&M campus, and so Marco, you know, went up to the Secret Service and said, would it be possible? And they said, yes, but you can go up to him, but don't you extend your hand. If he wants to shake hands, it's fine, but you don't. You know, it's those kinds of things that are not what servants do. Well, Jesus, in this passage, is saying he didn't look at all that as something to be held on to. He's willing to let that go because he has something else to do. You see, conceit would clearly say the opposite. Even one that says, here's a proper perspective of who I am, would almost say the opposite. And in a world like ours, which would be very in similar to the world here, maybe even more so in Greek, the idea of humility is just, that's a negative term. Very negative word. I was at a I went to an introductory course of or a session for a Dale Carnegie course once, and the instructor, she was listing traits, writing these traits on the board. I think it was like leaders or something, and she was writing, you know, people give them traits, and I said humility, and she didn't know what to do with that. I mean, she ended up writing it down, but she was stumped for a little. You know, she really had to stop and think about this. Was she going to put that down? Because it doesn't fit of what our typical way of thinking is. And so here it is. He says that Jesus, although he existed in the form of God, he did not require equality with God a thing to be grasped. One writer said, human evaluation may assume that God-likeness means having your own way, getting what you want. But Jesus saw God-likeness essentially as giving and spending oneself out. Well, it moves on in the next verse and it becomes a contrast. In contrast with what one might expect, Jesus emptied himself, or the NIV has made himself nothing. And if you notice, if we go back up and pick up the previous verse, in the middle verse, it says, did not regard, but emptied himself. So it is not this, but this. So it's not that he did this, but this is what he did. Well, so being equal to God does not mean filling oneself up, but on the contrary, it means emptying oneself out. Not easy concepts. Well, what does it mean that he was emptied? Or the NIV, that he became nothing. A great Charles Wesley hymn that is, you know, just a wonderful song to sing, especially at, with communion. And can it be? And one of them says that he emptied himself all but love. Great hymn, but is the theology correct there? What does that mean? He emptied himself all, completely of everything except love. Well, depending on how one understands his statement, perhaps. It works. But some have thought, well, this emptying means that he gave up his deity, or at least he gave up these certain relative aspects of deity, such as his omnipotence and omniscience, and that he actually gave those up. Well, once again, how can that be? How can he stop being what is essentially God? If he stopped being God, you couldn't be God. And as I already said, by definition, you have to redefine what God is if that's the case. So he couldn't have given up points of deity. He couldn't have given up attributes. So some have thought that. There's been lots of speculation what this could mean. It's his glory, his independent exercise of authority, these kinds of things. However, that really becomes somewhat speculative, as that's not what the passage says. The passage doesn't state what he emptied himself of in that sense. Though it's more likely that it's a poetic, a hymn-like way of saying that Jesus poured himself out, putting himself totally at the disposal of people. Consider the possible play on words that's going on here with the word empty conceit and the word emptying. Because if you go back and you even see it in English, because the way the translator chose to translate the word conceit, they said empty conceit because the word means empty. That's what conceit is. It's empty. And it's in the same word family. Kenodoxia would be empty conceit, and kenosis would be the idea of emptying here. They're in the same word family, so It's likely that he's picking these words specifically to make this contrast. In contrast to the person that's promoting himself in an empty, conceited way, Christ is actually emptying himself. So here's one person that is actually empty, but boastful of all that he should be, all that I want you to think I am. Then on the other hand, here's Christ, who is actually full of deity, and in some sense is pouring himself out or emptying himself, though it cannot be that he's emptying himself of deity as such. There's a sense in which his glory was veiled. For in it, here he is, God himself, but yet he walks on earth. And so his glory was veiled in that regard. Even on the Mount of Transfiguration, we see that veil of glory lifted as the glory of Christ is shown forth. So I think in that passage, what we see is this emptying is explained in the context by three phrases that follow here. They're parallel in Greek, being aorist participles. It doesn't necessarily show up that way for us in English, but there are three phrases that describe, I believe is the right way for us to understand what the emptying is, these three phrases. First, he took the form of a bond servant. What does it mean that he emptied himself? Well, he took the form of a bond servant. It says, verse 7, but emptied himself, taking the form of a bond servant, number one. Secondly, being made in the likeness of men, and number three, in verse 8, being found in the appearance of man. Those become not identical, but fairly parallel statements, especially the last two. That he was in the form of a bond servant. The same word we had earlier. He was in the form of God. Now he's in the form of a bond servant. Looking at the basic characteristics of a servant, that's what Jesus took on. He became a slave. Remember when Megan was born, just how we had this two-bedroom apartment in Dallas, and how we had cleaned that room so well, and I'm sure it's hadn't been that clean since the day that it was first moved into, probably 200 years ago, as old as those apartments were. And then while she was Robin and Megan were still in the hospital, I cleaned it again. And here it is, the God of the universe comes to a stable. What a contrast. What a contrast. He wasn't born a slave in the sense of slavery, but it was in that sense of a servant. He had the role of a servant. That was what his role was going to be. The call here is to serve one another, and we see this emphasized in this passage that Christ from the very beginning came into life in the role of a servant. He didn't come in, with all the advantages and all the rights. He came in as a person without advantages. He came in as a person without rights, without privileges, to serve mankind. And we'll look in a moment, but Mark 10:45 passage. I didn't come to be served. I came to serve. So he voluntarily took the form of a slave. Secondly, he was made in the likeness of men. Likeness conveys similarity or identity. It's not trying to say here that he just somehow looked like a man, but he really wasn't a man. No, he had, as the next man, he was found in the appearance of a man. That he was every bit man as anybody else, except that he had no sin. But he looked like people. He was in the appearance of people. He lived as people. He lived among people. He had the same physical aspects of people. He was everything that the original Adam was. He didn't have sin, though unlike Adam, in the perfect environment. Christ didn't live in a perfect environment. He lived in the presence of sin. He lived among sinful people. And he had the likeness, the appearance. So these emphasize the aspect of incarnation. He's fully identified with humanity. He really and truly was man. Yet at the same time, he's undiminished deity. That's the mystery of the incarnation. How is it possible that one person has two natures? He has complete deity and complete humanity. They're joined forever in one person. That's the incarnation. The incarnation in that regard is kind of the opposite of the Trinity. In the Trinity, you have three persons with one nature. In the incarnation, you have one person that has two natures. And so this is the focus here is he existed, pre-existed in the form of God. Perfect, undiminished deity. He took on, he didn't exist, he took on the role of a slave, the likeness of people, the appearance of a man. That's the incarnation. Well, this, all of this, incarnation, the kenosis here, the emptying himself, the pouring him out of himself, taking on this servant role, was for a purpose. And it's in that purpose is stated in the last part of verse 8, that his action in one sense was to empty himself, described in three things, to do something. He emptied himself. He took on a role of a servant. He appeared as a man in the likeness of a man, in the appearance of a man, so that he could humble himself. So that he could humble himself. Because how does God go to the cross? How does God humble himself to go to the cross? It says that he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death. How does God go to the cross and die? He cannot. So by joining himself to this human nature, it allows for Christ to humble himself and take this role. And so it says that being he humbled himself by becoming obedient. I guess all of us have learned some measure of obedience. Our parents probably never thought we learned it very well. But in some realm, you learned obedience. I don't know that anybody hasn't learned some aspect of obedience. Why does God need to learn obedience? Who does God have to obey? I mean, there's nothing for God. There's no obedience. That's a contradiction. I mean, who would God obey? But in the incarnation, Christ humbled himself, put him in a position that he could learn obedience and be obedient to God's plan, which was obedient to the point of death. To obey to the point of death, and in that death, on a cross. A cross takes on an artistic aspect for so much of us. It's depending on where that setting is. It's a symbol of Christianity. It's a symbol of victory. But at this time period, it was a symbol of a criminal. It was a symbol of a horrible death. It was a symbol of that you don't want to be associated with. So not only did he die, but he died the death of a criminal. He died this very painful, horrible death. So that's the example given of humility. Now, the question would be at this point then, okay, it explains that he had this attitude, an attitude that wasn't selfish, an attitude that was humble. But what it's not saying here that is understood is, why did he do these things? It wasn't self-serving to him at all. To the extent that God loves people and God had a plan and wanted to fulfill that plan, I guess it's, in that sense, self-serving, but the service is toward people that qualifies them to be saved, to be united in God's love. And so it says he became obedient. Hebrews 10:7 says, "Then I said, behold, I have come to do your will, O God." Luke 19:10, "For the Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost." That's his purpose, to seek and to save. And then Mark 10:45, "For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and give himself as a ransom for many." So his role, the example of humility is here, is for the benefit of others. So if you go back, was there some sense of empty conceit? Well, there's no conceit here whatsoever. There's no puffing himself up. There's the opposite of it. There's the pouring himself out. Did he regard himself higher than others? No, he actually put himself in a position below others. Did he merely look out for his own interest or the interest of others? He clearly looked out for the interest of you and I. And then, in a very quick transition, it moves away from what Christ's actions have been to what God's actions will be in response. So the actions of God are twofold here. That God highly exalted Jesus, and that God bestowed upon Jesus name of every name. So in verse 9 it says, "For this reason also," so because these things happened, this is the foundation of what God will do. "God highly exalted him and bestowed upon him the name which is above every name." So this has occurred, that following the resurrection and the ascension, that he was exalted. Now this exaltation in some measures have occurred before, such as that the baptism of Jesus, when God says, "This is my beloved Son," at the Mount Transfiguration, but even more so in the ascension. And it says that he bestowed upon him a name which is above every name. And in verse 10, "So that at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow of those who are in earth and on earth and under the earth, and that every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord." So God's action is he highly exalts him, he bestows the names on him, but then this action has results. And it results of this exalted Jesus, that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess. That in the future, there will come a time when even though the world has much rebellion against Jesus Christ, there will come a point when everyone will acknowledge that he is Lord. Will not be a saving experience. It's not that sense of recognizing he's Lord, but it is the recognition, the final recognition, that Jesus is Lord. And with this, he says, God will be glorified. That this occurs, verse 11, "and that every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord." And that this confession, this recognition, this response of creation to the exalted Jesus will glorify God. That God will be glorified through this action. Now, implied in this is that as one humbles himself, God exalts you at the proper time. That the call is one of humility, but the response of God, the actions of God in his own timing, is to exalt. So Jesus in a similar way, says the first shall be last and the last shall be first. This reversal of things. Those that humble themselves end up being first in God's kingdom. So it becomes an illustration, a model of how we're to react, how we're to live with one another as we follow Jesus Christ. So the statement in here is this tremendous theology which you can pull out and study the theology and the deity of Christ and the incarnation. But the passage isn't explaining to us the incarnation. The passage is showing us the incarnation as a picture of an attitude of humility and saying that's the attitude that we need to have. The same attitude that Christ had. Well, do you have comments or thoughts or questions or insights into this passage?
I noticed that in the King James translation, it says that he made himself of no reputation.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. You know, sometimes the translation
is
more difficult, but that one's pretty helpful.
And that'd be close to NIV because it says what? Made himself nothing. So no reputation. You know, and also I think don't they use the word robbery?
He didn't do that as right,
which is a little hard, but it has that, it catches that idea of grasping, seizing, you know, holding on to. Though robbery almost sounds like it wouldn't have been legitimate.
Yeah, says,
so that, you know, kind of.
I guess Jesus thought it not robbery,
yeah.
But the crime.
Yeah.
To think himself being,
yeah. Because, you know, that's where he's at. But no regard for his reputation. No regard for that. So that's a good point. Yes.
Is there some kind of connection, like I learned this one time, between the word for name and reputation? Like if he made himself?
I don't know. That.
Of no reputation, that might be kind of one of those juxtapositions with his name being exalted.
Yeah. I don't know the answer to that. You know, possible just on, you know, just by the very nature of, you know, name, the concept of name and exalting, but I don't know the answer to that. There is an interesting connection or possible connection. It's not a parallel in terms of like you can just look at them and say, oh yeah, these line up 1, 2, 3. But between this and Christ on the night before he went to the cross with his disciples and washing their feet. This sense of taking on the role of a servant, and you can kind of go through this role that he takes on, this role of a servant, and he unveils himself in the sense that he disrobes and you know, and has a towel around his waist and takes on this role of a servant, and then he's robed again in the sense of, you know, maybe that kind of an exalting, but you see. Yeah, you know, it's, while I said, while it would, you wouldn't want to say that's parallel in the sense of that they're teaching exactly the same thing. They're parallel in the sense that, once again, we see the role of a servant that Jesus took on this role. That was who he was. So with his disciples, when they're arguing over, you know, in that very, you know, very concept, here they are doing the opposite of what this passage is exhorting. They come into a room. There's no one there, which is the customary fashion, to wash their feet because there is no host. Nobody's hosting this party. It's their own party, their own dinner party. And so there's nobody there to wash their feet. And it's a servant that washes feet. So it's, you can imagine, we're all showing up together. And so, you know, we've been walking with Jesus, following Jesus, and there's this little, you know, thing that goes around from time to time, you know, who gets to be closest to Jesus, and hey, you know, why did Peter and John, you know, why did they get to go up on the mount? Why didn't I get to go up on the mount? And why is John always getting set closest to Jesus? And who's going to be on that throne beside him? And you got mom kind of interferes there and saying, Jesus, you know, my two sons, they probably ought to be 1 and 2. And you got this going on, and so they come into the room. And they look around and go, well, who's going to wash feet? Oh, it's not going to be me. You know, I'm vying for that number one position. And Jesus, of all people, takes on the role of a servant. which is exactly what this passage is saying. So that passage in John is illustrative of the same truth. They weren't willing to serve one another. They thought greatness was who was going to sit at the right hand of Jesus. And in essence, greatness and what qualifies, this is not stating scripture. Don't take this literal here, but what qualifies one to sit next to Jesus, by other passage would be the one that's last, not the one that's first, not the one who gets to the chair first, not the one that earned it, the one that, if you would, earned it by being humble. And humility is that tricky thing. I cannot remember the person. If I knew where I read it, maybe I could do an internet search and I'll find it. I don't know. But it's someone like Spurgeon. It couldn't have been Spurgeon because in the United States it would be somebody like Moody, one of those guys in that time period. But he asked somebody, how to be humble. He was trying to be this humble person to say, well, what you need to do is get one of those sandwich boards. You don't hardly ever see those anymore, but people were, advertisement, and you put the Plan on Salvation on it, and you walk through downtown Chicago. So he spent the day doing it, and he's taking it off. He said, man, I bet there's nobody else would do that. And he really, and his point is just how elusive humility is. You can turn it so quickly into pride. But here's the idea of humility regarding one another. Not a put down of yourself. It's not some sense of false humility that we go around acting as though we're less than. Humility defined in this passage is just don't inflate who you are. Don't merely look out for your own interest and see that other people are important.
Control decisions, and I'm willing to do whatever, Lord, if this is how it's going to be, and empty yourself to bond. The bond servant doesn't have a choice to control that. And if that's the point of it, it's not just humility of servant, because I can say, I'll be a servant, but it's how to be a servant.
True. Good point, especially in the context there where it says, goes through that and it says, humble himself, obedient to the point of death. So if you took that, then that role would be, corresponding for us is what is God's call in your life. So how do being obedient, and if you're going to use Christ as the example, then he was obedient to the nth degree, to the as far as you can push obedience, he was obedient. He was obedient to the point of going to the cross. So the very most that could be asked of you would somehow be to parallel that you would die a martyr. You'd be obedient to go to the cross. But even then, it would never parallel Christ, because the most you can die for is your own sin. Right. Right.
He physically gets to feel it. Now he physically can fear pain of man. That's the appearance. What makes us different is, okay, we do fear this physical thing. God doesn't fear dying. He didn't have to fear dying before. But now there is a physical skin. We fear, what's on the other side? We've already been to the other side. So
Yeah, so I mean, the whole role of, very well, just the incarnation is, everything that, becoming man so that these things could happen.
Is the second one the likeness of man, the volition, where poor God always chooses good, 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 so there's not a volition of good and bad?
I don't know, it's really, uses these two phrases, and there's, a likeness and appearance, and there's not a tremendous difference in them. Sometimes, you can try to make things, and often that's what you end up with words. Sometimes certain scholars try to make, huge differences in words, and then others say, they're basically synonymous. And you see that all the time when different words are used. But I think there, if anything, here, as with the other statements and we saw in the very first, you probably have more parallelism here than expansive differences. Different ways of saying similar things. Because they, for us, well, being the appearance of a man and being made in the form of a slave, that it's greatly different. I'm in the appearance of a man, but I'm not in the form of a slave per se. But if you look at it from the incarnation standpoint, those are basically synonymous concepts. I mean, it wasn't going to be. He didn't come to be a man so that he could be king at that point. He came, to be a servant, so they're all similar. And it's a little hard to pick up what the distinctions necessarily are of those last two. Though some would take the likeness and go back into the sense of creation and likeness, but I'm not sure how much you can legitimately do that.